My name is Dr. Ian Storch. I'm a board certified gastroenterologist and osteopathic physician, and you are listening to DO or Do Not. If you're interested in joining our team or have suggestions or comments, please contact us at doordonotpodcast.com. Share our link with your friends and like us on Apple Podcasts, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We hope you enjoy this episode.
My name is Carolyn Basalelli, and I'm a fourth-year medical student at New York Institute of Technology College of Osteopathic Medicine, also known as NYITCOM. Today we will follow the story of Dr. Austin Price. Dr. Price is a third-year combined vascular surgery/surgical resident at the University of Arkansas. Dr. Price wanted to be a doctor since he was in high school and started his journey by practicing as a certified nursing assistant at a nursing home for 5.5 years in Pennsylvania. He then went on to Nova Southeastern University for both undergraduate as well as medical school. During his training, he discovered a passion for vascular surgery and pursued a program which allowed him to match directly into the field without having to first complete a general surgery residency. Despite his very busy schedule, Dr. Price started a program called Action Potential Mentoring, where he helps tutor and mentor medical students throughout their education. We hope you enjoy this episode.
All right, Austin. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
It's a pleasure.
Austin, so you are a vascular surgery resident slash surgical resident. Can you tell me a little bit about that hybrid model and what that is?
Yeah, absolutely, Dr. Storch. So what it is it's the integrated pathway where you basically slam together general surgery plus vascular surgery simultaneously. In the past, maybe 10 years or more, back in the early 2000s, you could only do general surgery and then a fellowship into vascular with a 2-year additional. So it's like 7 years. Now with the hybrid program, vascular and gen surgery are combined into a 5-year program, and it essentially shaves off 24 months and you still do 36 months of general surgery.
2 years of time added back to your life sounds pretty good, right?
Absolutely. That was one of the driving forces.
So now the only issue though is you have to know that you want to do vascular surgery when you start, right? If you don't know you want to do vascular surgery, you can't do it.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And that's one thing that whenever I'm mentoring students that are interested in surgery of some sort, I tell them, listen, if you're not sure exactly which subspecialty you want to go for, don't go for the integrated program. Just go do general surgery and then you have some time to make that decision. Usually for general surgery, you don't have to really even know which fellowship you want to pursue until third or fourth year when you start applying for them. But if you know wholeheartedly you want to do vascular or cardiothoracic or plastics, then go full force towards those integrated programs because they're all going to save you time on the back end.
Yeah, that's great. Again, saving time is great, assuming that you know that that's what you want to do.
Yes, sir.
So Austin, tell me, we usually start by asking, you know, there's a lot of people, a lot of students, a lot of pre-medical students that think surgery is great. I'm going to med school and I want to be a surgeon. But can you tell us a little bit, especially your third-year resident, what your average, you know, I know there's different rotations and things, what your average day looks like, what time you open up your eyes in the morning to what time you end up coming home at night?
That's a great question. Great question, Dr. Storch. So it depends, certainly, like you said, which rotation, like definitely a transplant surgery month is going to be probably harder than almost any other month, just because you could be called for transplants no matter what hour of the day is, night, you're on call for the whole month, no days off. But pretty much every other month is going to be fairly uniform in terms of the amount of hours. It's quote unquote 80 hour work week. And I will say that it pushes up to 80 at a minimum every single month in surgery, from my experience at least. So usually I hit the gym before work. This is something that I actually kind of developed into my routine when I first did my very first transplant surgery rotation. And I started realizing that I was unable to go to the gym in the evenings because I had transplants almost always go overnight. Anybody that's done transplant will know it's like the witching hour. It's almost guaranteed that you're not going to get a full night's sleep. So instead, I just started going to bed very soon after I got home, maybe around 8:30 or 9 p.m. And then just waking up at 4 to be able to hit the gym before I did rounds. So kind of what my go-to plan is eyes open at 4 o'clock. My girlfriend's an OBGYN, so she actually calls me and I call her at the same time because she has to be up for her work up in New Jersey for OBGYN. So it works out well because she's on Eastern time zone, I'm on Central time zone, and we both end up waking up at the same time either way. So wake up, hit the gym, get back around 5 or so, and then take a shower and then get to the hospital around 5:30, depending on what time we have to round. Usually you're done with rounds by about 6:45 in the morning, and by 7 you're in the operating room. So usually first case of the day is going to be one of our bigger cases, whether it's an open aorta or maybe you have a fem-fem bypass or a carotid endarterectomy or something along those lines. And then the subsequent cases are usually a little bit shorter, whether it's an amputation or an angiogram, some kind of a peripheral endovascular procedure. And then we'll have a quick break for lunch. Usually we eat while we're chart checking and then go do afternoon rounds on our patients, usually around 3:30 or so. And most of the time we try and get out by 6. Doesn't always happen, but that's kind of the general outline of the days. At a minimum, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. And sometimes we start a little bit early and end a little bit late, but that's kind of the nature of residency, as anybody could attest to.
Now, Austin, do you have overnight calls?
So what actually happens is, in my program specifically, you start taking overnight call as a fourth year resident usually. And that's for the vascular surgery call pool. It's going to be all chiefs that take overnight call in case there's a ruptured aorta or anything like that that needs to be managed overnight. But I do have overnight calls when I'm in the general surgery call pool. And so the general surgery call pool is something that everybody that's a PGY1 through PGY3 has to partake in the vascular surgery program. So you're doing traumas, you're covering for transplant, cardiothoracic, plastics, emergency general surgery, colorectal, the whole nine yards. You basically cover for all the pagers and go to all the traumas. So you certainly do have overnight calls a couple times a month usually, but you start your actual vascular call pool in your fourth and fifth years.
Austin, tell us, how many of these programs are there, these combined vascular programs? Is that a very common thing, or is that more an exception than the rule?
So I actually didn't know about it at all until I got to medical school. I went to med school thinking I was going to either do geriatrics or general surgery, and kind of polar opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of work-life balance, in terms of intensity. But I knew I liked that patient population. And what I found is that emergency general surgery, trauma, they're super fun, but it was all age groups. And I knew in the back of my mind that I worked in a nursing home for 5.5 years as a CNA, and I wanted to work with the geriatrics. And so once I found out about vascular, I'm like, perfect. Surgery, plus it's the patient population that I enjoy. So that's when I went after that. In terms of the number of programs of vascular, I think right now it's 63 or 64, somewhere around there in the nation. And usually they only accept one resident per year. There's a few that accept two, but it's under 100 easily residents per year.
Yeah, that's great. That's spectacular. Now, we brought you on to talk about vascular surgery, to talk about your journey, but some of the students were very intrigued by your side gig. You have a separate company. Can you tell us a little bit about the company and exactly what the company does?
Absolutely. Thank you, sir. So it's called Action Potential Mentoring. If anybody wants to find us, we're on Instagram at apmentoring.llc. And so what it is it's my tutoring and mentoring company that I started to help medical students, whether it's pass the boards, step one, step two, level one, level two, as well as to get research, to get rotations locked in, as well as to write your personal statements, ERAS help, you name it, we help with it. And it's something that I've been doing now for about 6 years. We've helped almost 1,800 students. I started as I started just tutoring in the general anatomy lab, and then it kind of just progressed from there. And once I got to residency, I started the LLC and kind of formalized everything and started building out the entire team now. So it's been a great experience. It's something that I personally feel drives me every single day. Helps me have the discipline to wake up early because my students count on me to wake up because that's part of our routine. And then it's something that drives me when I get home from the hospital, because if I have mentoring calls, it's something that's got to get done. So it helps me stay fresh with the material from teaching it. And then it also helps me keep kind of my finger on the pulse of what's going on with the MASH process, how the algorithms are changing every year, and the way to kind of help students shortcut the best way possible to making their application strong.
Now, Austin, are most of your students osteopathic, allopathic, or do you have a mix of both?
So right now, it's probably about a 60-40 ratio. I would say 60% MDs and 40% DOs. And so we work with people that are from any school, any program, whether it's international grads, whether it's DOs, MDs, Ivy League programs, doesn't matter. Typically, people will find us because they're looking for USMLE help. And I get it. Everybody wants to pass step one and then crush step two. But at the end of the day, it's the whole package that we help with. We want to make sure that people are able to get the number of research that they need. Because if you're applying for a competitive specialty and you got two publications, it's going to be a rough run of it. So really, it's just everything that you need to make sure your application's kind of like tidied up with a bow on top to make sure that you're good to go.
So it's mainly for medical students, not for pre-medical students?
That's correct, sir. Actually, we don't work with pre-medical students, and simply because my area of expertise is with med school.
All right, Austin. So going into your journey, and you mentioned, my curiosity has already piqued about your CRN work. Can you tell us where you grew up, where you went to college, and when you decided you want to be a doctor?
Absolutely. So I kind of had the whole doctor plan since day one. That was really the only career that I envisioned for myself. And I know some people had that same exact journey, and then some people figured out late in life. I actually had a call with one of my students earlier this afternoon who's a pharmacist for like 20 years before medical school, and then she decided to go back. So everybody's kind of got a different beginning of the journey, but mine was in high school, pretty classic, knew I wanted to be a doctor. And at that point in time, my parents told me, they're like, we're not going to help you go to college if you don't get some kind of hands-on the job training to show that you're dedicated to the medical field, because this is obviously a huge investment, time, energy, money, you name it. College, medical school, it's a huge investment. And so I went out and got my CNA license, and I worked at a nursing home for about 5.5 years before medical school. The youngest CNA actually ever at Westbury Nursing Home back in Pennsylvania. So that was, I was kind of like the baby on the unit because I was like 16, 17 years old and helping take care of these elderly patients.
Austin, I hate to interrupt you, but just for those listening who might be interested in maybe they're pre-med and they're interested in doing a CNA job, can you tell us what kind of credentials you need and what exactly a CNA does?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was a CNA, that's a certified nursing assistant. And what you do is you basically help out RNs and LPNs with activities of daily living in a nursing home or a hospital. And you help wash patients, you help feed them, help get them to the bathroom, help them with activities every single day. It's basically like a couple steps above a volunteer because you get some like clinical acumen just from being around the nursing staff the whole time. And you're also obligated to do some of the, I guess you could call it the dirty work whenever you're taking care of patients, because a lot of people are kind of scared to get their hands dirty. And I mean, you know how it is. People have this whole vision of medicine that they think is ivory towers and it's awesome. But I think probably the best experience I've had in my entire life was getting that CNA job, because it showed me, number one, that I actually did have what it took. So the days wherever I was frustrated in med school or college and felt that maybe I didn't have what other people had, whether it was a good knowledge base or a good memory or good extracurriculars, I knew that I had the dedication of my patients, and that was part of what pushed me through. But to be a CNA, there's a couple of different ways you can do it. You can go through like a VOTEC, a Vocational Technical Institute, and get a licensure through there. I ended up actually going out of state and doing a 2-week crash course where it's basically like 15 hours a day or something like that, where you go through all the training for CNA, you learn all the proper ways to lift patients, how to use mechanical lifts, how to put in Foleys, all the kind of basic tasks that a nursing assistant needs to do. And so I got my licensure basically as soon as I turned 16, and then I ran with it. I couldn't recommend for pre-med students enough that this is the number one thing that you should do. Honestly, it changed my life, absolutely, without a doubt.
You're washing old people, turning them, right? Taking care of them.
It doesn't sound glamorous.
Yeah, it doesn't sound fabulous. It doesn't sound glamorous, but I agree with it. It's interesting. My wife actually is a dietitian who worked in the hospital for a number of years, and she, for a few years before she retired to take care of our kids, she worked in a nursing home, and it was a great experience. Like, she really bonded with the patients and loved it.
Absolutely, but, sir.
Yeah, great. So you're doing this CNA gig, and you want to go to med school. Tell us how your college was, how you decided on osteopathic school, and what school was like.
Sure. So I actually went to college at Nova Southeastern University. It's in Davie, Florida, pretty close to Fort Lauderdale. And I ended up sticking around and going to med school with the same exact program, but just the med school for the college. I was initially in one of the 3+4 accelerated programs for college into med school, where you do 3 years of college, which already secures you a seat into medical school. And around my third year of college, I realized, I was like, listen, there's no need to rush college. I'm having a good time here. Made a bunch of friends and kind of just was enjoying the process itself. So I decided to actually not rush that part. So I elected to opt out of that and did 4 years of college, and then ended up still sticking around and going to Nova for medical school. Nova now has a DO and an MD campus. Whenever I was there, it was just the DO campus. And I actually mentored the first class of MDs that Nova ever had, because it was virtually the same exact curriculum as the DOs. So it's kind of funny because they're learning from the same teachers, had the same lectures. They just didn't have the OPP classes.
Did you apply to other schools? Did you apply to other osteopathic schools, or was it just Nova that you
decided? I actually applied only for osteopathic schools. I didn't apply to a single MD program because a lot of my mentorship that I received in high school and college was with DOs. So I actually didn't apply to a single MD program. And I only went to one other interview until I got Nova's interview. And then I canceled all the rest once I got my acceptance there. So I knew I wanted to stick around in town. I love Davie from South Florida. Can't be beaten, in my opinion. I'll probably end up going back there for private practice after residency finishes up in 2.5 years.
I trained at University of Miami, so I totally get it. Love South Florida. No, amen. No place better. So Austin, tell us what med school was like at Nova. Tell us when you decided you wanted to do vascular surgery and what made you make that decision, other than the fact that you like old people and geriatrics wasn't for you.
Well, when you put it that way, it sounds like a an interesting decision. But really, the first exposure I had was I had received an email about a scholarship for the Florida Vascular Society, FVS. And this is my first year of med school. And I didn't really think too much about it, but I ended up getting another email and I'm like, listen, what the heck is this? I've never even heard of this. And so I just happened to apply for a scholarship that they had. It was called the Next Generation Scholarship. I think this is 2016 or 2017 at this point. And so I applied for the Next Gen Scholarship. I ended up getting it and they emailed me back and they said, well, one of the stipulations is you have to submit something for publication to get the scholarship. And I'm just a first year medical student. I didn't have any idea what they were talking about. And so I reached out to a couple mentors, asked them what I should do. And I ended up locking down a case report that I submitted about peripheral vascular disease. It was just a basic aorta iliac case. And so they ended up liking it. And so what I did is I taught it from a med student's perspective, rather than trying to come up with some crazy diagnostic criteria or some kind of literature review that I wasn't qualified to actually weigh in on. What I actually did is I turned my presentation into a teaching review of the current recommendations for aorta iliac disease. So it helped me learn the pathology, and it also helped refresh everybody else that was listening on kind of the basics of everything, of what we need to make sure that we're not missing with our patients. And so I ended up going to the conference. I think it was in Amelia Island, actually. And so what they ended up doing was, after the conference, they emailed me and said, hey, we're going to publish this in the Annals of Vascular Surgery. We really liked it. And this is my first exposure ever to publication. I had done some basic bench work research in college that didn't amount to much, kind of like most med students. And once I got this first publication, I'm like, well, shoot, I'm an M1 with a publication in vascular surgery, the Annals of Vascular, which is one of the bigger journals. So I might as well dive into it and see what else I can learn about it. And I ended up applying for the scholarship again the next year, of course, because I knew that the publication opportunity was there. And so it just kind of started snowballing from there, and it ended up being an awesome opportunity. The trials and kind of decision process between going for a surgery versus just geriatrics is probably the toughest part of the entire process. Because obviously it's a whole different lifestyle with surgery. You're up for 24, 48 hours sometimes, and geriatrics, I'm probably not going to be home later than 5 p.m. most nights. But I think later on in my career, I'll probably go back towards the nursing home and do either nursing home administration or something like that. So hopefully still keeping that in my back pocket down the road.
That's amazing, Austin. That's a great story. Now, when you applied for residency, did you feel like there were any barriers being a DO? Let me take a step back. The first question is, did you take the USMLE and the COMLEX? And when you applied for vascular, and we all know that surgery and the surgical subspecialties, especially when you're doing something so specific as you did that shaves 2 years off the path, is very competitive. Did you take both exams, and did you find any difficulty being a DO applying for a surgical subspecialty?
That's a really great question. So first off, with the first question, I did take both exams. I actually advise all of my DO students that are going for non-primary care specialties to take both exams. You can sometimes get away with it if you're going for primary care, because some of those programs don't require it. But the only thing that's going to hurt you is some programs will actually use the USMLE pass or the step two score as part of their screening protocol. So you might just accidentally get screened out because you simply just don't have that checkbox checked. So any of my students that are going for a competitive specialty, or they want to make sure that they leave all the options on the table, say they want to go to a specific region or they have a top hospital that they're interested in order to minimize getting auto screened out, I have them take the USMLE. And that was the same advice that I took myself as well, because I knew that applying for vascular, there was literally zero chance of matching if I didn't have a USMLE, because none of the program directors were DOs. And most of them on my interview path asked me what this COMLEX score even was whenever I applied. There's a couple programs that said that I was the first DO to ever even apply for this specialty. And so to your second question, was there any barriers as a DO? I will say there certainly was, but it was more of perceived barriers. The barriers that the program directors had were not even real, because I had the same metrics with the USMLE as my MD colleagues, but it was more barriers with administration and with colleagues and friends and people that had never heard of a DO going into vascular surgery. They were more the ones that said, oh, well, I don't know if this is possible, or maybe you should apply for a couple backup specialties as well. Or I think that it's probably not in the school's best interest for you to apply for such a competitive specialty, because it might throw off the match rating if you don't end up matching. So that was something that I certainly heard a lot of times, and just about every quote unquote advisor meeting at my school, they were not in favor of it. But I told them, I'm like, listen, I'm going to lock in. I'm going to get the USMLE score that puts me at the competitive level that I need to be for the specialty, and we're going to go with it. So I think really the biggest lesson that DOs need to know is if you have the score, that's going to open the doors. If you have the number of research projects for vascular, you need to have 15 to 20. Just that's going to be one of those check boxes. Do you have it? Yes or no? Especially as a DO, you have to have a little bit more than the MD colleagues to have the same percentage chance of matching. And once you get to that interview, it's just up to you to shine at that point. There's no MD-DO interpersonal conflict whatsoever. Once you've actually got to the interview stage, you just have to get there. That's kind of the be-all, end-all of it. And essentially, if you get enough interviews, you're statistically guaranteed to match, because you're in the same applicant pool with enough people that are applying for the programs. And so by the way that the NRMP match algorithm works, you're going to match if you have enough interviews. So really the goal is to just get the score, opens enough doors to have enough interviews to make sure that you match. And that's essentially, in a nutshell, what I help students with as well. So it's kind of at the end of the day, you want to make sure that you left no stone unturned and you did everything that you could do to make sure that you had the best chance of matching.
I think that's great advice, Austin. And I agree with you. It's like, if you go to an MD school, it doesn't mean that you're guaranteed dermatology. If you want if you want a competitive spot, you got to put in the time, you got to pay your dues, you have to have the scores. There's nothing's free, no matter who you are, no matter where you're from. So I respect everything that you said.
Thank you, sir. And I couldn't agree more with you. At the end of the day, DRMD, it honestly makes no difference. It's almost kind of helpful, in my opinion, because it lights a little bit of a fire underneath of you when you start hearing all these other med students and your friends at other schools saying that they're getting research handed to them, or they're getting publications just because of being in the classroom. And just like little edges that a lot of the MD schools have, even such as just their class exams being NBME tests. This is not something that exists in most DO schools. We're still taught by professors that are PhDs that are not teaching to the boards. And so you almost have to learn double, it feels like, because you're learning what the professors are teaching. Plus you still have to combine the board stuff, and you have to make sure that you're prepped high enough for the USMLE and the COMLEX. So it definitely lights a little bit of a fire underneath of you, in my experience.
Austin, again, thank you so much for your time tonight. I really appreciate it. I think we talked before the interview that the podcast is strictly to help students. Don't endorse them specifically, but I think that what you're doing is amazing and helpful to students that are interested in these services. Can you just again tell us, just in summary, where a student could find you and your company if they were in need of help, and exactly what students should be looking for your help and exactly what you offer?
Absolutely. So first off, to find me, probably the easiest place is Instagram or email. The Instagram is apmentoring.llc. That's apmentoring.llc. And then my email is draustinprice@actionpotentialmentoring.com. And so honestly, the people that reach out to me, there's a whole spectrum of students. It's people that are struggling just to get by with classes. And then it's also people that are looking to go from scoring a 250 on their USMLE to getting to the 270s. And so you can be on one end of the spectrum and jump up 70 points, or you could be at the top end of the scoring already and fine tune that last 5 to 10% on your score. It doesn't make a difference because there's different algorithms of what you need to do based upon where you're at. And one of my kind of ethos for the company is we don't have every student do the same protocols because it needs to be feedback loop based upon where you're at. And I'm sure you remember back when you were in med school, some students just got stuff easy. They walk into class, they sit down, and they just somehow remember all the stuff that the teacher said. I remember there was a kid in my class, his name was David. He went to the Hard Rock Casino with his loan money when he was in med school, and he just counted cards because he had such a good memory. He could just count cards the whole night and bring home 5 or 10 grand easily. And I remember seeing this kid and I'm like, how can you even compete against somebody like that? Like, that's crazy. But at the end of the day, if you can't apply that to medicine and if you can't remember the clinical scenarios, the best memory in the world doesn't help. And so you have to be able to piece it all together. And that's really what we do is we have something that I call the reverse pyramid, where we help students focus in on what it is that's actually important and going to help their patients in the long run. So to summarize, whether you're just trying to pass or whether you're trying to go for the top percentile, the most competitive specialties, that's what I'm here for. That's what I'm here to help with.
And then Austin, you also mentioned application process, you know, residency applications, you know, what type of services does the company offer as far as that goes?
Absolutely. So every single student, I personally go through their personal statement and their ERAS application, because those are two of the things that can make or break you. And so you want to make sure that it's hard hitting, has emotional triggers to make sure that the person that's reading it will identify with you, and that it's also very clear. Because at the end of the day, these program directors, if they're reading 500 to 1,000 of these applications, you don't want yours to just be something generic that gets looked over quickly. You want it to have an attention hook. You need it to have a good body that summarizes why you want to do the specialty. And you also want to drive it home in your conclusion. And so it's something that I go through line by line by line, every single student, because I feel that that's one of the most critical parts of the application process. At the end of the day, these people don't know you from the 5 other applicants that applied the same time as you. So you got to make sure that they have something good to remember you by.
Awesome. Thank you so much again for your time. You're awesome. Amazing. Everything you've done is awesome. Congratulations on your residency. Congratulations on your company. And congratulations for helping students be successful and following your footsteps. I think it's great.
I appreciate it, Dr. Storch, and it's an honor talking with you. I honestly genuinely enjoyed this interview, and hopefully somebody is able to take one nugget or one piece of inspiration throughout what we discussed today and apply it to their own life. And at the end of the day, that's what it's all about.
This concludes our episode of Do or Do Not. Send all inquiries, comments, suggestions, and even let us know if there's someone you want us to interview to doordonotpodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget to like us on Facebook at Do or Do Not Podcast for updates. If you enjoyed our podcast, please share it with your classmates and administration. We have plenty of more interviews lined up, and we're excited to share them with you. This is Tianyu Shea. Thank you guys so much for listening to Do or Do Not.